Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast covering the HBO original series Game of Thrones. My name is David Chen, and I've never read any of George R.R. Martin's books from A Song of Ice and Fire.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and I've read every book in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And we're here today to discuss Season 2, Episode 5 of Game of Thrones, The Ghost of Harrenhal. If you're just tuning in for the first time, you should know you can find all of our episodes at GameofThronesPodcast.com. You can also email us, let us know what you think of the show, at acastofkings@gmail.com. One last reminder, which I always like to give every week, we are primarily discussing this show as a television show and not as a book adaptation. So that means no spoilers from future week's episodes of Game of Thrones. That includes anything from the next time on previews on Game of Thrones on HBO, but also no spoilers that you know of from reading the book. And that means when you're emailing in, try not to spoil, although Joanna's screening all emails at this point, so I'm okay with that. But certainly when you're commenting on the show at slashfilm.com, please no spoilers from future episodes. So yeah, keep all that stuff in mind, please. And all that being said, Joanna Robinson, I have been absolutely astonished at the sort of level of interest in this podcast. Have not you been as well?
Absolutely. I am flabbergasted.
It's pretty amazing. I have been doing this podcasting game for 4 years or so, and I have never seen the podcast listenership grow at the rate that this podcast listenership is growing. So every single episode, we're adding hundreds, if not thousands, of new listeners, and it's pretty amazing. So first of all, big thank you to all the people listening for listening. We really appreciate it. We do this show for you. And so thanks for tuning in each week. Thanks for downloading. And thank you for leaving a review of the show at A Cast of Kings on iTunes. We really appreciate it. If you could give us a star ranking or a review, it will help to distinguish us from the hundreds of Game of Thrones podcasts that are out there. Thank you guys also for your awesome listener email and feedback. Again, you can always email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Let's discuss some of these feedback emails right now. Again, as I mentioned, this episode we're spoiling everything through Season 2, Episode 5 of the show. But let's talk about some of the stuff that we brought up last week in Season 2, Episode 4, which was Garden of Bones. J.R. Ferrasteros writes in, and you should also please let us know where you're from. Then I won't need to read your full name. But J.R. writes in, "Hey, Joanna and Dave, I'm loving your podcast. It's a fun way to debrief from the show. I wanted to offer a couple of thoughts from my background in biblical studies that I thought might be enlightening per some questions you raised in the podcast. Number one, Marjorie Tyrell and the political marriage. Marriage for romance is a relatively recent invention. In the ancient, medieval, and pre-modern worlds, marriage was primarily about social stability. At the noble level, then, marriage wasn't about who loves whom. We heard all about this from Robert and Cersei and Eddard and Kat last season. Marjorie doesn't care whether Renly loves or even likes her. She wants power. She'll do whatever she has to consolidate power. For her, that means having Renly's baby. And point number two, Sir Eddard Stark's bones. Most ancient medieval peoples didn't do any sort of preparation for burial. They let the flesh rot off the bones, or would boil the bones clean, then store the bones in bone boxes called ossuaries. This seems to be what the Silent Sisters do, and how Eddard's remains are returned to Kat. Anyway, hopefully you didn't do too much scouring around on Wikipedia or have any other Nerdalicious fans already shoot you that info. Love the podcast. Keep up the great work." Thank you, JR, for that enlightening information from biblical studies. Although I think JR is assuming a lot about the similarity between our world and the Game of Thrones world. Don't you think, Joanna?
I mean, I think you can make that point, but
I'm just joking. Yes, obviously it's analogous. So yeah, the whole bones thing, I think, is very illustrative of probably what they actually intended in the show.
What I was going to say is that it's not as far of a leap as some of the ones that you've made about, you know, wartime and that sort of stuff. So
okay, not sure what you're referring to, but I think the email is great and it really does help out. And I didn't know that those women were called silent. The woman with the strange backpacks, they're called the Silent Sisters, right?
Yeah, the fun backpacks.
Yeah, the fun backpacks. The death packs. cool information to learn. Okay, what else we got here? Okay, So this email will lead right into the show, I think. And that is, greetings, Mark from Albany writes in, I just got done listening to the most recent Cast of Kings. Great podcast, but I wanted to bring up a point regarding Joffrey's abuse of the prostitutes. You both had stated the scene wasn't really necessary, as we already know Joffrey's a sick bastard. Figuratively, and not in the Jon Snow way. And we've seen him act depraved before. Certainly we have. What we haven't seen, at least not from what I recollect of the first season, is someone getting the upper hand on Tyrion Lannister. His wit and intellect literally saved Tyrion's life last season, and so far this season he seems to be three steps of even Varys the Spider. He has yet to be bested. While Joffrey just did it in his own sick and twisted way. I'm not sure it necessitated yet another scene of depravity in a show filled with them, but I believe that was the intent of the scene, and not yet again to demonstrate Joffrey's psychotic behavior. Anyway, great job. Thanks for reading. So thanks, Mark, for that email. I think this is a great point, Joanna, and I don't think we quite made this point in this way on the podcast last week. So first of all, any thoughts on that or any response to that? Because we did get some criticism about saying that that scene was a little excessive.
Yeah, apparently people loved that scene, so that was interesting. But I think Mark does make a really good point, and I was trying to rack my brain to think if I had ever seen Tyrion get bested. I mean, Kat sort of bested him a bit last season when she got all her bannermen to capture him and that sort of stuff. But yeah, usually he just has victory after victory. And so it was interesting to see Joff get the quote-unquote upper hand. But what was also interesting is that we didn't see much of that fallout in this episode. There's like a brief offhanded mention of it.
Yeah, and that's what I was incredibly frustrated by that, actually, to be honest with you. Because if that was the whole point, right, if the point was not to be gratuitous, then you want there to be the reaction shot of Tyrion finding the sort of completely ruined prostitute at his door. But right. You don't have that. I don't know if it was budgetary reasons or they cut it or whatever. But yeah, it's just basically dismissed in an offhand remark this week. And that was actually quite distressing for me because overall, Joanna, I thought season 2, episode 5, The Ghost of Harrenhal, was a pretty weak episode. Probably one of the weakest episodes of Game of Thrones ever, in my opinion. But we can get to that in a bit. I mean, just in general, what did you think of season 2, episode 5?
I can't believe you think that an episode that starts with a smoke baby killing one of the main characters is one of the weakest episodes ever in Game of Thrones.
This episode started with a brutal, senseless death and ended again the same way.
Boom. But yeah. No, you know, a lot happened. They tried to do a lot in this episode, is my opinion. So there were some highlights for me, and one of my, like, a plot line that I really liked kicked off this episode. But I agree that I think they tried to do too much, is my opinion.
Yeah, and I'm going to say something that's going to make probably 90% of the people that listen to this podcast despise me, which is that I think that the Harry Potter series of films is a pretty crappy series of films, just in general. Like, I think if you're a fan of the books, it's great, you know, but I'd always held up Game of Thrones as doing what Harry Potter couldn't. And let me just very briefly say what I didn't like about the Harry Potter series of films is that there's just too much stuff going on. A lot of stuff, if you don't read the books, you just literally don't understand what's happening. You don't know what the rules of this world are. There's a lot of assumed knowledge about the past of these characters, or their relationships that's just not on the screen. And so as a result, it's hard for a newcomer to the series to really get into it via the films. And, you know, that was frustrating for me. And I watched every single Harry Potter movie. And by the end, I was just really waiting for this thing to end so I wouldn't need to talk about it. I would not need to talk about it anymore on the / Filmcast. Now, that being said, they had a really challenging task, right? They had, what, like 600, 800-page books that they're trying to compress into a 2.5-hour-long movie. That's almost impossible to do well. And some films have done that well. L.A. Confidential comes to mind, for instance. Like, huge book, tons of characters, great film. But they did not pull it off in the Harry Potter series, in my opinion. Now, what does that have to do with Game of Thrones? Well, Game of Thrones, you have one book that you're stretching out into a 10-hour series. And I thought season 1 was fantastic. You felt like you understood everything that was going on. And even though there's a lot of monologuing going on and a lot of talking about what's going on in the past, it never felt like they were trying to pack too much in or that they were assuming too much about what you, the viewer, knew, right? Am I making sense so far, Joanna?
You are. Thank you.
Yeah. And this episode, I really felt like we started to see the seams of the show start to come apart. And let me talk about why I feel that way. So, and actually, Joanna, you can help me provide some insight into this, because you can actually tell me whether or not it's this way in the books, or whether or not the show simply doesn't have enough resources or time to do what the books do. This episode starts off with Renly just totally straight up being killed off by the smoke monster. And that's a shocking moment for me. I mean, you knew it was coming. Was it shocking for you?
No.
But like the way it happened is what I'm saying. Like, were you like, oh, this is the scene when Renly dies, or did it still come as a surprise?
No, I knew. I was like, I kept waiting for Brienne and Catelyn and Renly all to be alone in a tent together, and I was like, and then waiting for the shadow to come.
Yeah, so that shocked me. I did not see that coming, because, you know, you've been building up Renly the last couple episodes as like, oh, he's a major contender for the throne.
Right.
So that he just was offed in this one scene is quite a shock. Now, I had two big issues with this scene, Joanna. First of all, I liked the fact that it was shocking, so that was really, you know, well done. Yeah, that was great. But I have two big issues. Number one is, like, Brienne's reaction. She's, like, all broken up about it. And I don't know, and while it is kind of, like, heartwarming to see how much she kind of, how loyal she was, and that's very, and the performance is great, it didn't really strike me that we knew enough about Brienne to know that, to really empathize with her pain here. Do you agree with me, or what do you think?
Well, I think that, you know, we didn't get to see a lot of Brienne and Renly, but nor do you in the book much.
Yep.
But what is implied and then definitely revealed by her reaction is that it's not that she's loyal to him. It's not that she loves him as a knight would love her king. She loves him as a woman would love a man, which that sounded so – as a woman would love a man. But like, you know, she's this very masculine, strong – awesome character, but she was in love with Renly, and that comes through when he dies and she absolutely flips the fuck out. So, you know, and that's why Catelyn is able to make a case for her. That doesn't even come into play. But anyway, that's why Catelyn cares so much about her, is because it's so clear that this poor woman loved this man, and now everyone is going to think that she killed him. And that's why they run off together.
Right. So. And so, I mean, that wasn't a huge issue for me, because whatever, it's a side character. You don't really see much of it. And, oh, she happened to really love this guy. And that's fine. But it's kind of like, how many of these relationships are we going to see that we don't really sort of grasp the fullness of? Do you know what I'm saying? That, but we're expected to kind of feel something for it.
Is it like the complaint you had a couple weeks ago with Samwell, Tarly?
Yeah, and actually that comes up again, where he's like, Samwell's like, oh yeah, Gilly would love this. And I'm like, what? Are we supposed to, I guess he just has a crush on her? Do they have some kind of special relationship? Because there's really almost nothing of that relationship in this show so far.
Right.
Do you know
right.
what I mean? So yeah. I'm just like, am I supposed to know more or feel more than I do right now? Because I don't. And that's an issue that I was wondering if it's going to come up more often. But the other issue I had with this scene, Joanna, is if Stannis has a smoke baby that can just appear out of nowhere and kill someone, it kind of dramatically changes the equation, don't you think? Like, why? What are the rules behind smoke baby appearances, right? Like, can the smoke baby just appear and kill Joffrey right now and Robb Stark, right? Like, what are the rules if that can happen? Do you know what I mean? And I know we're not supposed to know the rules yet, and I don't want you to tell me the rules yet, but unless they're established sometime, it's going to be very hard for me to feel that there are stakes that are worth kind of investing in.
Yeah, I hear you on that. It does change the equation in a great way because, you know, what happened last week is Renly was like, Stannis, what do you have? I have all the men and all the popularity, and you have nothing. And Stannis is like, I've got magic. And I think I told you before, Dave, but I don't think I've ever mentioned on the podcast that my dad sends me like one or two line recaps of the episodes, his fleeting impressions that generally crack me up. And this week he was like, can we send the smoke baby after Prince Joffrey? Is there a rule against that? Is that going to happen? He really needs to see Joffrey die. That's how my dad feels. So I can't answer about the rules, but I hear you where it's like, if you've got this magical weapon that can do almost anything at any time, then where are the stakes?
Right.
I hear you about that.
Right.
But I don't think that's what they've set up, but I could be wrong. So,
I mean, it's like a situation where in Matrix Reloaded, Neo could just fly away at any time. Do you know what I mean? Like, well, then why is he fighting, right?
Like, or like in Doctor Who, he's got this sonic screwdriver that can get him out of everything unless it doesn't. You know what I mean?
Right.
There's like these things that can work until sometimes they don't. Yeah, and
right.
I agree that that's kind of weak storytelling sometimes.
Yeah, so. Yeah. It could become a problem. It's not a problem yet. It could very well become a problem. All right. Mm-hmm. Anyway, moving on. Marjorie and Littlefinger have this interaction where, you know, Marjorie's like, and it's cool how this show does reflect on the nature of power. That seems to be the theme this season with Varys's like riddle and whatever. I like how it, you know, brings me back to my political science days at the liberal arts college. You know, like about like what is power? What does power really mean? It doesn't mean anything if people say you're a queen. Or if you're a queen, she wants to be the queen, right? If there's five queens, it doesn't make a difference if you're a queen. What did you make of this scene between Littlefinger and Marjorie?
I thought it was great because we saw so much contention between them last week, but you see this character, more and more of this character of Marjorie, who just is, she's a political player and she's willing to do she'll shift alliances at the drop of a hat. And Renly was her ticket and now he's dead. And so she's like, all right, who's next? What's my next best option?
Right.
I'm adaptable. And
yeah, like, it was solid. We also
it's not in the book. Not that important, but it's not in the book. And I thought it was a good relationship.
We saw a little bit more of Tyrion this week and extracting information from Lancel inside this tiny box out in the streets of King's Landing. Here's a clip from that scene.
You wouldn't lie to me, would you, cousin?
No.
That's a lie right there.
It is not a lie. Why would I lie?
Tell me, if the vile allegations against my brother and sister are true, do you think it would make Jaime more likely to kill you or less likely? When I tell him you're fucking her, I mean.
I'm telling you the truth.
The smart money would be on more likely.
She's making wildfire.
But then perhaps his own unnatural urges would give him sympathy for yours.
The Alchemist Guild has been commissioned.
There's only one way to find out.
They have thousands of pots already stored in their vaults. They are planning to launch it from the city walls into Stannis' ships and armies. Please.
When did she tell you this?
I heard her talking with the pyromancer. And the other night, after I left her, she went to meet him. I swear to you.
Swear to me on what?
On my life.
But I don't care about your life.
In the light of the Seven, by all that is holy and right, I, Lancel Lannister, do solemnly vow...
All right, enough. Even torturing you is boring. Just get out.
All right, so that was Tyrion tormenting Lancel. So they are making wildfire, which I guess is like the Westeros equivalent of napalm.
Yeah, or Greek fire, yeah.
And it's revealed that there's like tons and tons of it. The analog to our world today, I guess, would be nuclear weapons, it sounds like. It's not clear to me why, because Tyrion says, the contents would lay King's Landing low. So is the implication that the fire would be enough to, if used incorrectly, could also destroy the city? Is that what he's saying?
Could be that he was saying, you know, Bronn said something like, this is a shit idea.
Yeah.
And Tyrion's like, I agree. Cersei should not be in charge of this. I should, because Cersei will burn the city down by accident or something like that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. It sounds like, okay, I guess you could burn it down by accident, right? Like, if you're stupid.
Yeah.
It's not clear to me exactly why he needs to take control of the fire depository, but I guess, whatever. But yes, I feel bad for Lancel, and I'm also like, at the same time, I'm like, okay, well, also, during this scene, I felt to myself, dude, like, you push a man hard enough, no matter how pathetic and cowering he is, he could react poorly. And then, of course, right after, he's like, tell Braun to kill you in case something happens to me. And so I'm like, oh, I guess that's how he solves that. But still, I just feel like something is going to give that relationship sometime at the current rate that it's progressing at.
You feel like Lancel is a looming threat.
I feel like if you push a man hard enough, if you push a desperate man hard enough, you know, unpredictable things can happen. As I've seen in my own life when I've been pushed hard enough.
I see.
All right. Also, what happened this episode? We got a glimpse of the Iron Islands, right?
The Iron Islands.
Yes.
That's right.
Okay. Got it. Every single week seems to be the further humiliation of Theon Greyjoy, right? Like, there seems to be no depths to which this person cannot be humiliated in. And this week is certainly no different. We saw his crew has no respect for him. And then I'm not entirely sure what the interaction he has with his first mate is. Like, they talk about some kind of strategy to take Winterfell or to attack the North. Can you explain this to me, Joanna?
What he said was that if they attack a keep that's nearby Winterfell, Winterfell will send all of their men to defend that keep. That's literally what they said.
And then that would theoretically leave Winterfell open to attack.
Right.
Theoretically. Now, whether then what Theon is going to do in that situation, we're not clear on yet, but that's
right.
Okay, gotcha. But I thought his humiliation was rendered really nicely here. What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think the character of his sister is being used very well to quash him. And what you were just saying about Lancel, there's only so far you can push a man before something breaks, something happens. So, what I think we're seeing is, where is Theon's breaking point? You know, how much humiliation can he endure at the hands of his family? And where is that going to push him?
Although it seems as though he has it more together. Like, Lancel seems like such a pathetic individual. Theon at least has, like, he's seen some stuff in his life. It seems like he can take a lot more than Lancel can. So that's just my feeling. And he has his plan. That's obviously going to work out really well for him and his family, right? So, you know, I'm being sarcastic, of course. But, something horrible is going to happen, I assume, with whatever Theon's plan is. Either it's going to go wrong, thus humiliating him further, or it's going to go right, and he's going to be called upon to sort of reevaluate his loyalties once more, if I had to predict something. Or a third option that I'm not aware of. What else do we see here? Oh, yeah, Davos and Stannis have this confrontation in their tent about what is going on. It's the first time it's introduced where Melisandre having too much power, like, why that might be a bad thing. And I don't know, like, if we're instantaneously supposed to agree with Davos here. Like, what is your sense of this scene? Like, are we as the audience supposed to also believe that Smoke Baby / Melisandre would be a bad influence on the Seven Kingdoms?
Don't you think she is? Weren't you just talking about the way in which her smoke baby sort of changes the equation in sort of an unfair way?
Well, I just think, like, for instance, this is the first scene where it's introduced, like, oh, this magic can have negative impact. And I think to, like, Star Wars with, like, the dark side, when you know, it's like, Luke, you should fear the dark side, it was very clear why that's the case. You see the Empire, you see their brutal, cutthroat ways. We don't really know exactly what is negative about Melisandre assuming the throne at this point. I mean, yeah, it's weird and unconventional, her powers and everything, but do we necessarily know it's evil other than that it's a black smoke baby? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, is just the visual supposed to be enough to make us think that it's evil?
What I would say is, as odd as it seems, I think there's a vast difference between declaring war on your brother and sending a magic smoke baby to kill your brother. You know what I mean? He killed his only brother.
That's where you draw the line.
That's where I draw the line, morally speaking. You know, it's a different – warfare is bad enough. And Catelyn was talking last week about trying to remind them that they were brothers. But sending – you know, knowing that you're sending an assassin to kill your brother so that you can have the throne, that's a different – kind of confrontation, in my opinion. So yeah, I would say that Melisandre is a negative influence on Stannis.
Okay, that's fair.
And a seductive negative influence on Stannis. And just like the dark side is very seductive, and because it's easy power. You know what I mean? And the other thing that, that Davos brought up that I liked that we've seen a bit this, this season is the idea of religion. She's got a different religion than most of the, she comes from, you know, across the sea. And so she's got a different religion from most of the Seven Kingdoms. And we haven't delved too much into the religion of Westeros, but there's the seven gods, the sept, that's sort of the main thing. And then this red god who she follows, the god of light. And he's mentioned again later by another person who's a foreigner. And so it's an interesting religious war. It's like, you know, having a Mormon run for president or something like that. You know, it's just like, it's that idea of religion, I think, can't be discounted entirely either. It's not just magic. It's a different religion
right,
as well.
Right. That makes sense. But we, again, we don't know anything about these religions is the thing. Do you know what I
right.
mean? So,
You as the TV viewer don't, and I agree with that.
I'm not saying I don't look at Melisandre and the Smoke Baby and think they're evil. Obviously I do, but I just don't know that the show has done enough to establish that fact.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Well, I think, and
I don't want to judge based on appearances, Joanna. You know, I don't want to judge on appearances. Obviously.
I see. You're a very giving person.
I'm a very progressive viewer, obviously.
What I'll say is that I think the point of that scene more was about how I saw it as reflective of that scene with Catelyn and Brienne, where it's this relationship between a knight and their king, or a knight and their liege lord, or whatever. And this idea that Davos and Stannis have this relationship where Davos can tell him what he calls the hard truths. And you have, as a leader, you have to have people around you who will, you know, confront you and tell you the truth, and not just be yes men around you. And that's what Davos can do for Stannis, which will ultimately make Stannis a better leader if there are people who will call him out when he sends a smoke monster to kill his own brother. And you saw that ceremony between Brienne and Catelyn, where you see the beginning of that kind of relationship, which I really liked. I sort of saw it as two different stages in that knight and lord relationship,
right,
or lady.
Right, and such a great scene too. It's just kind of, the word I use is heartwarming, but just kind of cool to see these people unite their bonds of friendship verbally. Do you know what I mean? Or I'm sorry, establish their bonds of friendship verbally, you know, or of loyalty or fealty or whatever the word is. But two strong women in this show, obviously, in a TV landscape that usually doesn't have that many strong female characters. Really well done scene with the kind of swearing oath to Catelyn. But yes, point taken about the Davos-Stannis relationship. Stannis, who continues to prove himself as not a particularly likable character at all. Like, this is not a guy who I look at, I'm like, man, I want that guy to rule me, you know?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Whereas Renly, you're like, yeah. Cool me, Renly.
Clearly. Well, Renly is, yeah, actually none of them are particularly good. But except for maybe Rob. But, and we, of course, don't forget Joffrey, who's already doing a kick-ass job.
Oh, he's just the best.
Or a beating prostitute-ass job. So we also got some more details of the Arya plotline this week. Some pretty interesting stuff. This is turning out to be my favorite storyline here. And she has this confrontation with Tywin Lannister.
Girl. Where are you from?
Maidenpool, my lord.
And who are the lords of Maidenpool? Remind me.
House Mouton, my lord.
And what is their sigil? A red salmon. I think a Maidenpool girl would remember that. You're a northerner, aren't you? Good. And one more time, where are you from?
Barrowton, my lord. House Dustin. Two crossed lynxes beneath a black crown.
And what do they say of Robb Stark in the north?
They call him the Young Wolf.
And?
They say he rides into battle on the back of a giant direwolf. They say he can turn into a wolf himself when he wants. They say he can't be killed.
Do you believe them?
No, my lord. anyone can be killed.
So I got chills, man. Such a good scene. And you see this scene in the trailer for this season when she says anyone can be killed. And now we get the context here. And it is just such a great scene between the performances, the lighting. Yeah. It's the dialogue, obviously. It's awesome. Now, Joanna, this has been bothering me since I watched this episode. Can you clarify, is Maidenpool, like, from the South? Is that what, like, she tried to fake that she was from somewhere else first? Is that what happened?
Right, yeah.
Okay.
Because she just wanted to separate her identity. You know, she does not want to be identified as Arya Stark. So she's like, I'll say I'm from way far away. So yeah.
Right, and then she made up another place that was closer to her. Right.
I mean, it's a real place, but yeah, it's closer to Winterfell. So.
And that she probably knows more about and can fake better. Right.
Exactly.
But it's understandable why she would have lied in the first place, because she's in the presence of a bunch of Lannisters. So,
right. How amazing was Charles Dance's face as Tywin Lannister when she says anyone can be killed, and that just close up on his face as it changes and hardens. I agree. I got chills.
Really? I thought the awesome part was when the close up on her face, she's like, anyone can be killed. Because Joanna, there's a double meaning there, right? Tywin doesn't know he's talking. She's talking about him. You know, that's what I love. It's pretty awesome.
But or does he? I mean, I think that's why his face changed.
Okay, interesting.
When she was like, because she's a girl from the north, and she goes, anyone can be killed. He knows she's there in service by force, and she's looking at him and going, anyone can be killed, and his face got really tense and scary. And so I felt like, not like I'm going to kill you, but I hope you die, because my lord, her allegiance would obviously be to Robb Stark, you know?
Really? That's interesting. I did not get that at all. I actually thought he was kind of, he had this look on his face like that she was acknowledging that Robb could be killed, and therefore he's like, damn straight type of thing. Not like, mm-hmm. Oh, you're talking about me. But yeah, cool that we had like totally differing interpretations of that scene.
Yes.
Speaking of scenes that have completely differing interpretations, this week we found out what the hell Zarro's game is. He offers Daenerys tons and tons of money in exchange for one thing.
And it can all be mine.
Oh. Well, let's just say half. More than enough to buy horses, ships, armies, enough to go home.
All I have to do
is marry me.
That was a romantic proposal.
I've already married once for love, but the gods stole her from me. I come from nothing. My mother and father never owned a pair of shoes, but marry me and I will give you the Seven Kingdoms. And our children will be princes and princesses. See, I have more ambition than you thought. The time is right, Daenerys Targaryen, first of your name. Robert Baratheon is dead.
A couple of interesting things about this scene. Number one, it's like she didn't even know that Baratheon was dead, right?
Right.
And so it's funny because it's been like five episodes where we've or six or seven episodes where we've known that, but you realize, wow, she really has been out in the middle of nowhere for a long time.
Yeah, there's no Wi-Fi out in the desert,
right,
Dave. Like,
unfortunately,
there's no way for her to get a text or anything. So
and apparently the Raven infrastructure is really bad out in the whatever lands that she was wandering in for quite some time. Not that anyone would have any occasion to tell her anyway. So that was kind of interesting to see how we know all this information that she doesn't know.
Right.
The other thing is that in the scene after this, her manservant, please remind me of his name, Joanna.
Ser Jorah Mormont.
Ser Jorah Mormont, yes. So he's like, look, you shouldn't join with this. You shouldn't marry this guy. And I don't know that we're supposed to really understand the motivations that are going on in this scene at this point. Like, is he saying you shouldn't marry this guy because he really thinks it would be tactically a bad idea to marry this guy? Or because, you know, obviously he's kind of in love with her. Likewise, what is her reaction? She's like, yeah, look, see about these ships. But what is she really thinking? Because it did not strike me that it was very clear that she was going to go with Mormont's plan.
Right. So. I think what I really not spoiling anything because we're a bit off the map here from the books. What I think it was they were trying to convey was Jorah is giving her bad advice because he's in love with her and does not want her to marry Zara. And she didn't believe that he was in love with her until he pitches this stupid plan of let's take one ship and go to Westeros. That's way better than a whole fleet of ship and a lot of gold. Let's take one ship and go, just you and me. It'll be great. And then she gets this look on her face like, oh, he is in love with me. He's giving me shitty advice now.
And she's like, awesome. It's just like this look of concern. You know, yeah. It's like this, like, yeah. What is going on, you know?
Well, yeah, because she relied so much on him, and now she realizes that the relationship is more complicated than she had thought.
Right.
And what I loved about the Daenerys scenes in Qarth was this this identity pull that she's feeling, which was played out really well with her two sort of handmaidens.
Right, one of whom is ethnic looking.
And right, yeah. Is she a Khaleesi or is she a princess? Is she a Targaryen or is she, you know, part of the Dothraki horde? And is she going to leave that behind, you know, to go claim the Iron Throne, or is she going to hold on to, you know, the people who put her where, you know, where she is? And I don't know. So, I thought that was interesting. And you saw it at the garden party and all that sort of stuff where it's like, you know, she's trying to reconcile these two sides of her.
Yeah, a lot of entertainment going on at the garden party with the Dothraki, which is like, you know, I can't imagine that party would happen without some kind of incident. Right, you don't put this is not these aren't just like regular village people. This is like high society. You're putting a lot of Dothraki in there, and this got something would have happened. I'm just pointing that out there.
You know how the Dothraki like to celebrate a nice occasion. You saw a Dothraki wedding,
right? With minimum three deaths, right?
Yeah, so, and some good old fashioned raping.
Yeah.
So I'm
surprised
the fact that they just stole some gold is really, you know, just minimum.
It was pretty funny the way he's like he threw out the wine and like took the cup. That was hilarious.
Yeah, exactly.
That was hilarious.
And what did you think of the Qarthian warlock that showed up?
Whatever.
That whole scene.
At this point, I'm just like, you know what, like. What? Nothing surprises me anymore, Joanna. I'm just like, is this all going to make sense in the end? Are there going to be some rules? Are there going to be some stakes? Right?
Ever since Smoke Baby, is it like all bets are off ever since Smoke Baby?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's okay. Right. Yeah. Right. And until they establish that there are some bets that are on, I'm going to assume that all bets are off.
Okay.
We only have 5 minutes left here, but a couple of things I wanted to mention that we didn't get to. The way this episode closes... Jon Snow is going out, and what is? I didn't understand this scene really. I understand that Snow is they have to like take out the lookouts, right? But who are they fighting again?
The Wildlings and Mance Rayder, the king who is north of the Wall.
Gotcha. And who is like thinking of making an assault on the Wall, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And then Jon Snow kind of is like rises up from his steward position to become a ranger. Now that struck me as a little weird because, why? Isn't the Black like a pretty strictly regimented organization? Why would they just let him fight? You know, like then what's the whole point of making him a steward in the first place?
Well, what Corin Halfhand, who's the guy who's going to lead the ranging party, what he said is. Mance Rayder, who's the king of the north, I know we're pressed for time, but he's the king of the north. He's organized all the wildlings, and they're going to march against the wall. He used to be part of the Night Watch. So Mance Rayder is making the wildlings more like the Night's Watch.
Right.
And so what Corin Halfhand says is, we have to behave more like them, the wildlings, in order to outsmart them. We can't play by our same rules. So you said it was tightly regimented, and I would agree. But in this case, they're just going to run off with five people, I think four or five people, and, you know, try to get, attack as much as they can. And in that case, I think, you know, as we've said before, all bets are off.
Right. So, yeah, okay, that makes a lot more sense. Thank you for the explanation.
You're welcome.
Thanks. So we'll see how that unfolds. I hope that... Jon Snow is victorious, but as we found out last week or a couple weeks ago, he got his ass beat by an old man. So who knows where his skills are at right now. And finally, this guy, the sort of creepy molester looking guy, who Arya released from jail, is actually very great. Not only grateful and not going to molest Arya, but actually willing to kill for her. And she chooses as her first death the Tickler, which is the most threatening name ever. But she, you know, the guy who was torturing people using rats. Is that correct?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So why did she choose the Tickler as her first death? Because when she said that, I'll admit, I was like, oh man, Arya is totally ready for this request because she's been lying awake at night reciting names of people who she'd like to die. Why not just go straight to Tywin? But the more I thought about it, the more it's like, hey, that's actually kind of a smart move. You want to see if this guy is actually going to like deliver, not only is in a position, but is actually going to deliver on his promises.
Right.
So, and I love that look that Arya gives at the end. It's not really a smile. It's more of like a smug, satisfied look when she's looking down at the corpse of this guy. What did you make of that sequence?
This isn't Arya's first kill. This is her second kill, I would say. But it's her first intentional kill. And so I think it's a big leap for the character. This isn't who she picks in the book, but they didn't have time to establish the character who she picks in the book. So, but I think you're dead on about why not go straight for Tywin Lannister.
Right.
In terms of, you know, testing out whether or not this guy's offer is genuine and why show your hand right away with go kill the Lord, you know, that might get you killed. Why not just say, well, this guy who tortured people, I mean, that's a reasonable vengeance to want to enact.
It's reasonable vengeance. That's nice oxymoron there. overall, like some great scenes in this episode, but I don't know, man. You're right. They tried to do a lot, and I don't know what's going to happen in the next five episodes. Whether they're going to be able to tie it all together, whether they can successfully establish stakes. I'm very nervous because this is not like season one where I thought like everything in terms of the storytelling and the world itself was under control. I don't feel that way about this episode so far. Your thoughts?
I just want to wait and see, I guess.
All right.
I'm afraid of saying anything damning, so I will just wait and see.
All right, sounds good. Well, again, you can find every episode of A Cast of Kings at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. And you can also email us, let us know what you think of the podcast, and give us feedback for this episode at acastofkings@gmail.com. I've been loving the feedback. Keep it coming in. We really appreciate it. We'll keep reading it on the show when we have a chance. Joanna Robinson, where can people find more of your work on the internet this week?
Every day on pajiba.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at @QuitYourJRob.
You can find me at twitter.com/DaveChensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y, DaveChen.net. I do a couple of other podcasts as well, a storytelling podcast with actor Stephen Tobolowsky at TobolowskiFiles.com. You can also find the film podcast I do at /FilmCast.com. That's the word /FilmCast.com. Thank you guys for listening to A Cast of Kings. We'll see you guys next week.